Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a jam-packed show, starting with singer-songwriter Tyler Shaw. He talks about his rising music career and what he hopes to accomplish with his music. We also talk to social media expert Patrick Charles about why rapper Jay-Z is spying on you. Up next is Irish band Heathers talking about working with David Guetta and CeeLo Green, not to mention their socially conscious song, Forget Me Nots. We wrap things up with American cyclist Mark Waite and his take on the sport and if it can recover from Lance Armstrong's disastrous behavior.
Capture your need for sound.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is a rising star in the Canadian music scene, Tyler Shaw. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hello, Kelly. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I'm really excited to talk to you. You know, you're doing so great. You've had obviously a very busy year. Can you tell us actually how you got your start? Because, you know, we have people that are listening from overseas right now and they might not know about you quite yet. So did you always want to be a singer and how did you get your start in the music industry?
Well, basically, I started playing guitar when I was around 13, 14. And it just kind of, it was a hobby, it was a passion. I loved playing it. No matter what, you know, I'd come home from school, pick up the guitar and watch TV while I play subconsciously, and then I'd play consciously sometimes too. So last year around this time of year, I won the Much Music and Coca-Cola Covers Contest, it was called. I submitted 4 covers, and I ended up winning out of 13,000 submissions over the nation of Canada. So that was super, super awesome. I was super honored to get that award. And then after that, I was put into a bunch of writing sessions to find a song to be released by Sony Music. And we ended up writing a song called Kiss Goodnight in the fall. And we were just like, yep, this is the one. So we took that tune that we wrote and we mixed it, we produced it, we released it on iTunes and to the radio. And a few months later, we find out that it's doing super well all over the country. It's on iTunes and it went gold like 2 months ago, which was amazing. You know, so that whole year from winning up until now, because it's been pretty much exactly a year, having a single, actually 2 singles now, out on the radio is just so overwhelming and it's just so, so cool. It's a dream come true, basically.
Now, the new single is called By My Side, and can you tell us, was there a lot of pressure to write that second song, like, because Kiss Goodnight did so well?
You know what? There was a little bit of pressure, you know? Everyone was like, Kiss Goodnight's so good, blah, blah, and, like, you know, it did do really well in radio and in iTunes. So there was a little bit of a weight on my shoulders just to, you know, top it or make something better, you know? So I went into every single writing session I had, and I was like, you know, we have to bang out a good one. You know, just got really into it, and you know, I think we did a really good job, apparently. So I love the tune. The feedback has been great so far since it's been out, so I'm happy with it.
You know, we've been talking about this sort of being a very busy year for you. What has been the most rewarding part so far?
Oh man, just to have this passion, but also pretty much have it as my job. Because, you know, I wake up every morning and I'm like, what's next? Like, I always want to move forward. It's not like one of those jobs that you have and you wake up and you're like, I don't want to go to work today, you know? I wake up and I'm like, what can I do? Like, what can be done? Like, let's write songs. Let's do this. Let's do that. So I think having this as the start of a career, and I want to do it for the rest of my life. So it's just, I love waking up and thinking to myself, like, this is my job, and I love it.
Can you explain the writing process for me? I know we talked about you being in writing sessions. Do you have a way that you do things? Like, I know you play guitar, so do you write stuff on there first, like musically, and then come up with lyrics, or is it lyrics first? Like, how does it happen?
It really all depends on that day, or usually, you know, you have something that you made a month ago, and you revisit it, and then something sparks it. You know, one song that I wrote, actually, on my way to the writing session, I saw someone, a man passed a girl, And as he passed her, his jaw dropped, and he was just, he held his heart. So that, just like little things that you see around your everyday life can inspire you to write a song. It doesn't necessarily have to be from yourself. It can be from something that you see that you can turn into a story. So that's basically what I do. I always keep my eyes open, my ears open, anything, you know. I could be just sitting somewhere in a park or something, and a tune would pop into my head. I'd grab my phone and write down the hook, and just, I'd go with it, you know, just go with the flow.
Are there producers or songwriters, whether here in Canada or elsewhere around the world, that you know about that you would love to sit down and work with?
Oh, I know there's tons of producers. I can't remember the names just off the top of the head, but I know obviously LA has a plethora of people that are ready to write hit songs. Toronto's been great, though. I've met a lot of amazing people here and written with them, banging out a couple tunes and stuff. But overseas, too, in Europe, there's tons of people who've worked with Katy Perry and obviously Justin Bieber and stuff. So, you know, maybe not yet, but once I start getting out there more, then we will definitely maybe cross paths.
Now, you are in Toronto right now, I understand, and obviously, I guess you're sort of living there now, even though you're from the West Coast. Do you get homesick for your family and even just for your hometown?
You know, I do. I really do. I miss, it's been, how long has it been? Eight months since I've seen my family. I did do a little promo trip out there back in early spring, but I was there for 4 days and maybe saw them for one and a half of them just for a dinner. But yeah, I do really miss my family, my brothers, my sister, my mom, stepdad, and my father. Friends especially too, you know, like moving to a city where you basically know no one and having to, you know, kind of develop a new friendship, which was actually easier than I thought. But at the same time, you have that connection back at the West Coast with all your very, very close friends that you've grew up with. And you have that different kind of connection back there. But, you know, I know why I'm here, and I know why I want to be here. So I know this is a good move for this moment in time for me to be in Toronto.
Can you talk to us about the, I guess, scope or the landscape of Canadian music? We just had the Much Music Video Music Awards, which is obviously a huge thing for Canadian talent. Also, we have a lot of international stars that stop by. Ed Sheeran was there, Taylor Swift, Demi Lovato, the list goes on and on. So obviously, Canada has a pretty big role in music, if you will, around the world. And you were at the Much Music Video Awards. Can you talk to us about how you feel the landscape is, and do you think it's a really good place to be for an up-and-coming artist such as yourself?
Oh, amazing. It's amazing. Like, you know, being from Canada, we're so proud of our country. So having artists from this amazing place is just a bonus, right? You have Sean Desmond's Canadian. I'm Canadian. Justin Bieber is Canadian. You know, like, we have all these great artists, and it's just amazing to see them do so well from a great nation.
And do you feel the push or the pull, if you will, to want to make it big in the States and elsewhere? Because it seems like whether you're from Canada or you're from Britain, I think America is always a big draw to see if you can do it there too.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'd love to get into the U.S. market there and overseas and wherever else I can, really, because sharing my music is what I want to do. And I don't necessarily have to be, you know, like, super popular, but I just want to see how it goes. You know, we never know what's going to happen unless you can try, right? So if we try to get in there, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But if it does, then that's even better.
Now, recently I was able to see you perform live sort of at an outdoor stage, and you had tons of fans that came up to you after your performance and were taking pictures and you were signing autographs. What does it mean to Tyler Shaw to have someone come up to them and tell them that they love your music and it's making a difference in their life?
It hits the heart. It really does. It's like, it's really heartwarming for sure. You know, it's an experience. I remember the first time someone, can I have your picture, please? And I was just thinking to myself, you want my picture? Really? Like, why? So it's really crazy to have that feeling in your heart. But yeah, I love it. It's crazy.
Now, I know you're on Twitter, and you can reach him at Tyler Shaw Music. How does it feel to connect to your fans directly through social media, and are you addicted to whether, you know, Twitter or Facebook?
I am. Tyler Shaw Music is the tag, right? I'm on, you know, quite often, tweeting and checking out fans and whatever, and retweeting and favoriting and all that stuff. So even on my Facebook page there.
And Tyler, what can we expect from you in the next, like, 6 months? I know you've been obviously very busy the last 12 months with the two singles, and now that the second single's out. What can we expect from you, you know, as you push forward towards 2014?
Well, it actually looks like we are moving forward with an EP release, so like a 5 to 6 song album, to be released probably by the fall. So I'm very excited to share what we have coming up, and I hope you guys are too.
That's awesome, Tyler. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it, and we wish you the best of luck with everything.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Kelly.
That's Tyler Shaw. Again, make sure to follow him on his Twitter account, at Tyler Shaw Music.
Hey guys, this is Tyler Shaw. You're hanging out on The Kelly Alexander Show.
I woke up today thinking of you. I think that I know what I want to say. Gonna tell you tonight, it's you on my mind, and I can hardly wait.
Happy to welcome back onto the show our good buddy and social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. It's been a long time.
So this week, rapper Jay-Z released his new album with a pretty unique theme. and his new album, you know, Magna Carta Holy Grail, is a smash by putting his head together with people at Samsung. The problem seems to be that this might infringe upon privacy issues. Can you talk about all of this and clarify?
Yeah, well, it's pretty crazy because the thing is, he made this deal with Samsung. And basically, if you have a Samsung Galaxy phone, you could get this app and download the album early, right? So mm-hmm. you get to hear it for just the whole thing is like, basically you can listen through your phone, right? So that's the first thing that he wanted to do. The first thing is that he wanted to make everybody who has one of these phones have it right away. Okay, have the album right away before everybody else to give you incentive to A, get a Samsung phone, and B, get his album to make sure that, you know, an old school guy like himself, he still wants to have big sales on his first week.
Right.
Now, the invasion of privacy part is that when you have a Samsung phone or, you know, any kind of phone, you sign up for things and they always ask you for information, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing. It seems like Samsung was looking to get a lot of information from his fans
because
people are complaining that the app wanted like some permissions that were kind of interesting. It wanted the ability to view all of the contacts in your phone.
Gross.
It wanted the ability to view all of your email addresses.
Wow.
And to, of course, to post on your behalf on Facebook and Twitter.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, that's the standard thing. It's like everybody loves to give you stuff for free, quote unquote.
Right.
But in reality, though, they're always getting something from you. Advertisers, the information is being sold,
mm-hmm.
so they're giving you this album either for free or at a great price, whatever they you know set, what kind of scheme they set up.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, they're getting something really valuable out of it.
Wow! And obviously, he was down with all of this, Jay-Z, knowing that this would happen to his fans.
Yeah, but what's funny about it is there was an article in the New York Times actually talking about it, and it's pretty funny that a guy like Jay-Z, who, you know, raps about being stopped by the cops and raps about feds lurking
mm-hmm.
behind him, it's kind of funny that he would, you know, be into this idea of, you know, people basically spying on you through your phone. Now, you can say, of course, that, you know, people have to say yes and agree to it, but nonetheless, I mean, we all just say yes to everything. How many times have you said yes to the new iTunes terms and agreements, right?
Right.
How many times have you just like click yes, click yes, click yes. Okay, let me listen to music now.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I'm guilty of that stuff. If it's apps, though, I have to say I don't. Like, I a lot of times have shut down things, like, because I didn't like that. But I could see, you know, a lot of people, like, just being in the frame of mind I am when it comes to the iTunes thing, saying yes. Like, you just don't want to read the 67 pages of legalese that's in front of you.
Absolutely. And that's what's happening. And that's what they're trying to take advantage of. So they're finding a new way. And also, like I mentioned before, the idea that a guy like Jay-Z, who's used to selling a lot of records back in the day when people were still selling records, I don't think he'd like the idea of having a new album sell 25,000 copies.
Right.
You know, lately people are doing backflips when they go over 10,000, but that's for newer artists. I mean, newer artists are just like, they want to get the word out there. They want to get their music out there. But for guys like Jay-Z and also for his wife, Beyonce, they have to make the biggest splash,
mm-hmm.
just like back in the day.
So obviously, I guess the point of all this is the bottom line is money, but is it, I guess, you, like you said, the information that they want the most out of it so they can keep using it?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, money is still the bottom line because the information just leads to money. They want to know where his fans are, what they can market to them, you know, where they send emails to. That's the kind of stuff that people want to find out these days, you know? And what was interesting is that Samsung agreed to buy 1 million copies of the album before it was released to guarantee that he would sell 1 million in his first week, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. So at first, this is the interesting thing as well. This is another funny thing that that Jay-Z has changed. The recording industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have this certification process, or they used to, where they wouldn't count these sales for a month. So that would mean that the album would not have the 1 million sales for the first week.
Okay.
They wouldn't have it until the fourth week, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they've actually changed their policy because of this.
Really?
So. Yeah, so they're saying their excuse is that they're saying, well, you know, we're trying to change with the times, and nobody really knows what's going to happen with the internet and with the music industry, so we're changing the way this is done. So basically, now this goes back to the old days, like Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis Presley's manager, used to buy Elvis's records, so you know he would get on the radio. That was like the oldest trick in the book as far as the music business goes. But now I think a lot of other bands are going to start doing this, where the management will just say, well, our promotional campaign will be to buy a bunch of your albums so we can say that, hey, we sold 300,000 the first week.
Oh my God, it's going ridiculous, eh?
No, it's pathetic.
Oh, it is pathetic. So obviously, now that he's started this, you know, his good buddy Justin Timberlake might do this on his next album, or like this is gonna have a domino effect, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it will. I think, you know, a lot of people are going to look at this and say, hey, this just opens up the whole plane to more stunts in the industry, more ways to get people to, you know, say, to almost to trip people into buying albums in a sense. Because the bottom line is, I mean, everybody wants to have things for free. Ever since 1999, Napster started free downloads, and then YouTube. Most of the time, people would rather just listen to stuff for free. So it's hard to convince people to go out and buy music again.
Wow. Do you think like fans are going to have a backlash with this? Like,
no, I don't think so. Because, you know, to us, I find this really interesting. But to people with a lot of young fans, I don't think they see too much in it. I don't think they read too much into it. Like the whole thing with advertisers buying your information, you know, just like the thing about the NSA spying on you in the U.S., most people don't really care, because what most people want is to get as many things as possible for free. So if you can sign up for everything, that's why so many companies are like, sign up with your Facebook, because Facebook buys that information. Facebook wants to know what you're interested in. So this is what we're at right now. So the younger people who don't really care about it, that's the way the world is headed.
Wow, this is crazy. First you upset me a few weeks ago with that ticket buying, and now this, Patrick. But you know, I feel like it's really important that consumers know what's going on, and just so that you're aware, like if you want to click, you know, okay, then fine, but know what you're letting happen to your information.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with it, as long as you're okay with someone having the particular information that they're going to have. Because my point is that if you allow Samsung and Jay-Z to know everybody in your address book and know, you know, people you're emailing, things that you're buying, that sort of thing, then just know that you're going to get more targeted Facebook ads.
Yeah, right.
And if you hate targeted ads, mm-hmm. you want to be careful what you sign up for.
Yeah, because it's creepy already. Like, I don't really have a lot on my Facebook page, to be honest with you, like with regards to likes, but it's funny how it's figured me out to a fair extent already, just right. with the few things that I've had. And I'm like, I mean, sometimes it's interesting, you know, like I freely admit that I love, you know, Janet Jackson. So I'll get R&B suggestions and stuff
of
like
course.
That. And, you know, I'm a John Grisham fan. So they'll sort of let me know that his new book is coming out or whatever, or somebody like him. But yeah, like it's creepy how much they know just based off of like two or three things that I've put. Because I'm really careful about what I put up there. And it's interesting to know that just off that, they sort of can know some things.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Very
but
crazy.
That's the way it's going.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for this. As always, we really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll see you next time.
That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Again, you can find him on Twitter @GetPatrick. Also on The Kelly Alexander Show, KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Joining us on the show is Ellie from The Heathers, who are a fantastic band from Dublin, Ireland, and they recently released their sophomore album, Kingdom. Ellie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk to us about how you guys actually formed as a band? Now, obviously, you and your sister Louise are twin sisters. How did everything sort of come together?
Yeah, well, we started Heathers in 2007. We spent our teenage years going to gigs and kind of started getting into music properly around then. And a lot of our friends were in bands, and we kind of decided we'd try ourselves to write a few songs. So we started in 2007, and we released our first album, which was called Here Not There, in 2008 when we were 18. And kind of went from there. At first, it was kind of really just us having a bit of fun. It wasn't very serious whatsoever, but then slowly it started to become more serious when we realized that people actually liked our music. So, and then about, I think it was 2010, 2011, 2012, we were writing our second album, which is called Kingdom, and it's complete, and we've just released it, so it's exciting.
Can you talk to us about Kingdom? Like, where did the title come from, and is there, like, a major theme surrounding the album that you want your fans to take away from it?
Yes, well, okay, Kingdom is, first of all, it's quite different to our previous material, so we've got full band, and it's a lot more poppy and a lot more energetic. And the theme behind the album is kind of searching for this perfect place that maybe doesn't exist, or maybe it does exist. And we've called the place Kingdom. So that's kind of the theme behind it. And a lot of the songs are really it's kind of the place that we were in when we were writing the album. So there were a lot of things going on for us, and it's kind of, you know, are you going to run away from things, or are you going to, you know, power through? And yeah, a lot of decision making. But Kingdom is this perfect place that maybe it exists, maybe it doesn't.
Now, the first single, Forget Me Nots, what's that about? And again, it sounds like there's a really powerful message behind it that you want your fans to take from it.
There is. Forget Me Nots is a very important song to us. One of our friends took her own life a couple of years ago, and we wrote this song for her. And the message behind the song is kind of really in the lyrics. The main theme running through it is, it's all right not to feel okay. So it's kind of a hopeful song, and it means an awful lot to us. And there's, in Ireland anyway, there's a stigma attached to mental health and depression and suicide, and it's kind of trying to fight that and say it's all right not to feel okay.
After this friend passed away, do you find that it really impacted you? Obviously, you wrote the song. Do you think it changed you as people and as songwriters because of like having such an experience close to home?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it changed. It was kind of like a spin of kind of terrible things happened after that, and we were both kind of in a strange place, because when something like that happens to you, like especially when it's someone who's very close to you, really, really, really affects you and kind of everything that's going on in your life. So, and I think that's when a lot of Kingdom came from us, you know, a lot of Kingdom came from that and everything that kind of came from that experience. And it's definitely, it's completely changed how we think about life. And it was a very horrible experience, but it's really kind of changed the way we think, and you know, if that makes sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And you know, we have a lot of people that are listening around the world. Where the show's actually played on radio stations in Australia and Japan and Singapore and Malaysia. So for people that maybe are just getting to learn about you, can you describe your sound from the Heathers? Like, what are you guys about?
We are, our sound is quite, it's quite poppy, punchy music, and with a lot of feeling and a lot of energy. And our music is very, it comes from the heart. It's exactly what we're feeling and what we're thinking. Yeah, and two twin girls.
That's awesome. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Ellie from Heathers. Make sure to check out their website, heathersmusic.net. Can you talk to us about David Guetta? It sounds like something exciting is going on there.
Yes, well, we signed, a couple of years ago we signed, well, actually a year ago we signed a publishing deal with Universal. So one of the upsides to that is we get to write music for other people. And actually, aside from that, we were contacted by David Guetta's people. He heard Forget Me Nots on a US blog and really liked it and asked if we'd be interested in trying to write for him. So we've been working on that. We've been working on writing for a lot of different people, and it's exciting. It's a nice thing to be able to do, and, you know, try to write different music that's not just necessarily Heathers. And myself and Louise are really influenced by so many different types of music, so it's nice to be able to experiment a bit. So yeah, it's exciting.
Are you a fan of electronic dance music? Because, you know, David Guetta is obviously everywhere, and so are, you know, all these DJ, you know, producers like Alex Godino and Morgan Page. Like,
yeah,
everyone knows about the Calvin Harris. So how do you feel about that, and do you want your Heathers music remixed?
Yeah, well, we love it, and we've had a couple of people remix some of our own songs, and like, they've been absolutely incredible. And myself and Louise, actually, we listen to a lot of that type of music. We're interested in writing for that kind of style of music. So it's like, when we got that call, we were kind of shell-shocked.
That's awesome.
So it's great. So,
and I understand something is also happening potentially with CeeLo Green.
CeeLo Green, yeah, well, again, that's another project which we've been working on as well. So there's lots of different things going on in the background. It's what we do in our downtime, writing for the people. So it's great.
Now, where do you want to take Heathers? Like, do you have like world domination plans, like, in, you know, down the road?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Well, we love playing music, and it's really exciting at the moment because we've just released our album over here and we're about to release it in Central Europe. And, you know, getting to do so much traveling and see all these amazing places, meet loads of people and play our music is wonderful. And who knows? I mean, We love so many different types of music. Our first album was quite different to our second album, so who knows what our third album is going to be like. So we'll see. But it's exciting, and things are going well at the moment, so we'll see what happens.
Is there an artist or a producer out there now that you'd love to work with? Like, obviously, it's amazing to know about Guetta and CeeLo Green, but is there someone even maybe who you looked up to as a kid growing up that you'd be like, wow, like, I would love to work with, you know, Madonna or whatever?
We are about massive Beyonce fans.
Great.
Yeah, so people kind of, they're like, what, when we say that? But yes, we're both ginormous Beyonce fans, so I'm going to say Beyonce.
That's amazing. Yeah, because I would never picture that. That's really cool to know about. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And can you talk to us a little bit about social media? Like, you know, I've been on your website, heathersmusic.net. It seems like you guys are very active. Do you appreciate sort of being able to connect with your fans so personally?
Definitely, yeah. I think it's really, really important, and social media is so great for getting, you know, getting everything out, like whether it's pictures, videos, music, you know, even just something that you have to say to people all over the world. And, you know, we get messages from people in really random places that I've never even heard of, you know, saying, oh, I heard your music, and that would have been, you know, unheard of years ago, you know. So it's really, really great, and even just for keeping people up to date with what we're doing, and it's really, really important for us. So
awesome. And Ellie, do you have any message that you'd like you know, new fans to know about, you know, you and your sister in the band, because again, a lot of people are going to hear this?
I'd say have a listen, see what you think. Our new album, we absolutely love it, so hopefully you will too, and come see us play sometime if you can as well, because we love playing music and we put on a good show.
That's awesome. Ellie, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Ellie from the Heathers right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. You can learn more about them on their website, heathersmusic.net.
Take it anymore, so it's all right not to feel okay. It's all right.
cycling has seen many doping scandals over the years, but never one as big as the Lance Armstrong scandal. In the past year, we've witnessed Lance Armstrong not only admit to doping, but also be banned from the sport for life, and to also be stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles. So what does this mean for the future of the sport? Can cycling ever come back from a scandal like this? Mark Waite is founder of Cycling, CEO, and joins us to talk about the future of cycling. This 2-time national champion and member of the 1988 U.S. cycling team believes that the sport can and will reinvent itself. Mark, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Mark, when did you first get on a bike and when did you start competing?
Good questions. You know, like everybody, you start riding your bike when you're a kid. When did I get serious about it? Was in the fall of 1984. I started out initially as a runner, a distance runner in high school, and then went off to West Point and ran cross-country and indoor and outdoor track, and suffered 3 stress fractures in 2 years, and just decided enough was enough, and decided I had a competitive. I was looking for something competitive, and I'd never tried cycling. And you know, my personality is one that you know I'm always willing to try something new that I haven't done before. And so we at West Point they have a cycling team. It was a club sport because when you're there at the academy, you know it's a military academy, so you've got to compete. You got to be participating in some physical sport, whether it's a varsity sport, a club sport, or intramural. So I just decided, well, you know, I got to do something, so let me try cycling. And so I took it up, joined the cycling club in the fall of 84, and kind of bumbled my way through for the first year, just learning how to ride and be competitive on a bike. And started about a year later, I started actually seeing some results, and just more because I was learning how to train properly, and I was just getting... You know, cycling and running, there's a lot of similarities, but there's also a lot of things that are different as well. So learning how to ride and learning how to train properly and actually then getting into a race and learning how to race.
Can I ask you what it is about cycling itself that you absolutely love? Because I'm always fascinated to talk to athletes about their sport and to find out, you know, what it is, like what is that thing that keeps them going back for more, especially when you guys are training like crazy people and, you know, no one else would do what you guys put yourselves through.
Good question, too. You know, for me, it's just the enjoyment of just getting out and going and getting away. Because when you go run, you know, and again, unless you're a marathoner where you're doing a 20-mile run, you know, usually when you know, you're doing 3 to 5, maybe 10-mile runs, your routes are a lot of times are very fairly similar. But when you get in a bike, you get to go out and you can go, literally go places, and you can go someplace different all the time, and you can experience new places and new areas. And for me, even after I stopped racing and I've continued to ride just for the health benefits of, and because I enjoy it, is if I have a chance and I go on vacation, you know, and it's someplace where I can take my bike, I take my bike, you know, and that's my get up early in the mornings and I go for a ride, and it's my way of exploring. That's the best way to put it. So I get to, you know, you get to explore new places and go do new things. And even this summer, for example, later this summer, I'm going over to Italy to be part of a world championship tour that I've been invited to participate in. And it's right before the Worlds in Florence. And I've never ridden in Italy. So this is going to be like kind of a great new experience. You know, these sorts of things that make it fun because it's something new that you haven't done before. Not to say you can't do it in, you know, when you run or do other sports, just getting out there and also then being able to do it where you can, you know, it becomes a social thing as well when you go out and start doing it with groups. So you can just start building, you know, new relationships, getting to know new people. And if you move, for example, move to a new area. So, you know, we moved from California to Georgia back in 2006 and then from Georgia back to California 2 years ago. And so I've always gone out. I had a buddy of mine. We'd go ride. And recently, but earlier this year, I found a group that goes out. Of course, they go out really early in the morning. They leave at between 6 and 6:30 in the morning, 3 days a week. But it's a bunch of business professionals. They all live in the area, and they all love riding their bike. And it's just a chance now to go out and kind of build and expand your social network.
Can we talk a little bit about what it was like to be a professional athlete? For example, what was your schedule like when you were actually training for the Olympics? Because I think that's also fascinating to just sort of get an idea about what you guys were going through, you know, on a daily basis leading up to such an important event.
Sure, sure. Yeah, in 88 was, for me, was it was rather unique because I started out the year, I set up my goals at the beginning of the year and said, here's what I want to do for the year. And at that time, I had kind of being, making the Olympic team kind of as my dream goal. And as we all set those up and you say, okay, you got to have something that's really a stretch, a dream goal that, hey, it's a real big stretch, but you put the work into it, you put the effort into it, the possibilities are there. And, but my goal for that year was to, get to nationals and be a national champion. The challenge was at the start of the year, I was an individual rider. I wasn't on any trade team. So at that time, now we have all these professional trade teams, whether they're domestic here in the U.S. and in Canada, or you get some of the bigger pro teams like Garmin Sharp and Radio Shack. But, that back in the late 80s, it was the concept of a domestic pro team didn't exist. You had these amateur trade teams that were had big sponsors. So, companies like Crest and Coors Light, Subaru, they were big sponsors of the amateur trade teams. But I started out the year and I trained. I put in the effort. I put the effort in the gym through the wintertime, and I'm a person that hates going to the weight room. But I realized if I was going to get better, if I was going to get stronger, I needed to put the time in and improve areas where I needed to make improvements. So I'd go to the gym and I 2 days a week at the gym, and I'd be doing a tremendous amount of leg strengthening, and I'd do stuff that would be like, for example, like leg presses. I'd do 5 sets of 50 leg presses with like 400 to 500 pounds, and I'd do 5 sets of those of 50 reps. But at the end, I was exhausted. But to me, that was part of getting better, is pushing yourself and building that, not that short-term power that guys need to sprint, but that longer, the ability to have the power over a longer period of time. Because, I'm a guy, I'm 6 feet tall, and at that time I was 170 pounds when I raced. And so I was very lean. I had about a 4 or 5% body fat. But the problem was is that guys that I raced against that were the other top road riders were smaller and lighter than me. And so I had to make it up by, if I couldn't be lighter, I had to actually build up my power-to-weight ratio. And that's really how I approached it. So in the off-season, starting in about December through March, I was in the weight room 2 days a week. I was putting in miles on the road, excess of 400 miles a week on my bike, which meant that there was usually 2 days where I was, where today they talk about training in hours, I'd train in miles, but but I'd be putting out 2 days a week, I'd be putting in, 90 to 100 miles a week twice a week. And then other days I'd just be out, I'd be climbing, just putting in a lot of base miles and building up the strength and the endurance base. And then just start, and then I got into the spring racing, and I didn't really do any speed work intervals, but I let the racing, I built up my racing endurance and, got the all of that you typically do through intervals, just coming through doing a lot of racing in the spring. And then when we got it really into the meat of the season, it was racing a lot, travel a lot of time in the car or the plane, traveling to races, doing the stage races that existed back then, which would be, usually 3-4 day stage races. And again, in the springtime, I was doing this on my own. I was not on a team. And it wasn't until early May I got picked up by a team. It was 10 Speed Drive. And they were, for anybody that's been around cycling for that length of time in the 80s knows that 10 Speed Drive had a run in the late 80s where almost every year they won the team time trial national championship. So to be picked up by them and then being asked to be part of the team time trial team was a big thing for me. So now I was going and I was training with the team time trial guys. We were doing stage races. I went with the national team over to Europe, got to race. I was over there for 2 weeks. And we raced, a little less than 2 weeks. We did a stage race in Sweden that year. And it turned out I was the top American. I was eighth place overall. And, came back and then we had nationals. But it really was that once the season got started, it was race all the time, and you know, you recover between the races, you know, and just, you know, keep going. And that's really what it was. I mean, we spent, let's give you ideas, you know, we that in 88 to get to Nationals, we started, you know, on a road trip from the, I can't remember when it was, the Southwest. I think we started in Albuquerque, and we were in the team van, and we drove all the way up. We did a stage race in Bend, Oregon, and then from there, we went from Bend, we went up to, drove up to Spokane for Nationals. Yeah, the life of an amateur athlete, you know, wasn't glorious, let's put it that way, but it was fun nonetheless, and it was rewarding. It was worth the effort because I saw the results of my time.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is founder of Cycling CEO, Mark Waite. For more information, check out their website, cyclingceo.com. If we switch gears a little bit here, Mark, and I guess get into the seedy side, if you will, of your sport, which I don't like to say, but obviously it's everyone knows about it. Were you aware of doping going on back then? Was it more of a thing in the 90s? And were you at all surprised about these allegations that have sort of tailed Lance all these years up and until his final admission of doing these things?
Yeah. So in the 80s, there really wasn't, you heard about, you know, supposedly like, you know, the European pros, because it's a hard life, especially back in the 80s, you know, where the money wasn't that great. And if you'd go into Europe and race, you know, you're up against these guys that were trying to get into the pro ranks. That was their escape from working on the farm or, you know, hard labor life. And so a lot of them would do what they had to do to try to get there. And so it's a whole different, it was a different mentality in Europe than it is here in the States. You know, we had the room, you know, that came out from 1984 in the Summer Olympics. There was the talk about some of the blood boosting that occurred, which at the time wasn't illegal. I had also heard from, you know, some of the guys that I raced with that, that there was talk that, you know, the worst that was happening is that, you know, people were doing caffeine. Now there, you know, certainly there was limits on the amount of caffeine you could have in your system, but they never tested for it. I was never a coffee drinker. I didn't drink soda. So, you know, I was never one to even ascribe to caffeine. But there was talk that, you know, some guys would say, oh yeah, well, when we were given, you know, these, and I'm not going to go into gory detail on it and what they would say, but, you know, they would just, it was a caffeine based, you know, kind of type of thing. But when I raced, I never really saw, you know, I didn't see anything, you know, just kind of heard, you know, very, very little. And, you know, as we got into the 90s, you know, I think that's really where it started taking off, and, you know, people started looking, because money was coming into the sport. Keep in mind of that. I mean, that's what drives, it's just like any professional sport. You know, money is what drives people to doing, you know, stupid things. And in the 90s, because Greg LeMond was the first cyclist to score a very big cycling contract, which at that time, I think it was a multi-year, you know, six-figure contract, which was huge in professional cycling in the early 90s. And then you started getting big sponsors. You got the French businessman that had Lobby Claire, you know, and then you had some other bigger, you know, businessmen coming into the sport and business owners and companies. And, you know, so everybody's competing for the dollar. And the way, you know, in the way you get paid, you make money is you generate results. And if you were successful, you got more money. And I think that started driving people to look at ways to improving their performance. Specific to Lance, you know, I knew Lance when he started racing in 1989. We were on the national team together. He, you know, came out, wowed everybody. I mean, he was as strong as an ox. The one thing about him I would always remember is that he hated climbing. You know, he just would not want to go uphill. But he managed to, you know, and part of that is I looked at it as, okay, this is a guy that's just getting on the bike, making a transition from triathlons, where all they're used to doing in triathlons is you get out there and you just redline it and you go as hard as you can for as long as you can. But when you get into cycling, obviously it's a longer, you've got to measure your effort, especially when you're talking about going uphill. So part of it was attributing it to, you know, he needs to learn how to climb, how to go uphill, especially long climbs that are, you know, not 100 to 200 meters long, but, you know, maybe, you know, 5 kilometers long. And then in 1990, I left the sport at that level and just, you know, continued to enjoy it and went into my business career. But, you know, I followed the sport, and, you know, a part of me wanted to, when he went through the cancer, his cancer treatment, you know, I wanted to believe that, you know, what they said, what he would say is, you know, hey, this is all because of what I went through on the treatment. And that, you know, because I can't say that. I've never been through cancer, thankfully. And, you know, I don't wish it on anybody. But I have no idea what, you know, when you're taking all these different drugs for chemotherapy and for recovery, because he had to take EPO for the chemotherapy recovery. I have no idea what the cancer does to your body and then what the recovery does. You know, so, you know, it made sense that, okay, well, maybe it does, you know, reshape your body. And he got back on the bike, and just through more focused training and development, you know, he was able to take his natural talents and really, really hone them in into being a really good rider. But, you know, there was always a part of me, too, that, you know, there's always that little seed of doubt, like a number of people did, is, you know, is he or isn't he? And unfortunately, you know, we kind of saw and heard it all earlier this year after, you know, years and years of denial. And, you know, the more he kept denying it, the more he kept saying things about, you know, I've been tested hundreds of times, I've never been positive. Just things like that, all of a sudden you start really thinking, you know, there's probably, you know, whether the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. And sure enough, you know, we found out that there is.
Now, when it comes to, you know, Lance Armstrong's doping scandal, obviously he's not the only one. Obviously he's the most prolific, mm-hmm. I would say, in the last while for sure. Do you think that the sport has been tainted by all of this? Like, is everyone going to be skeptical of it? And how can you, or how do you think it needs to move forward from this and get back to its pure form?
So I look at it, so let's separate this into two parts. There's the professional sport, which is, you know, the sport that we all, you know, that we see now that Lance participated in, you know, the Giro d'Italia, the Tour de France, you know, and even some of the domestic professional races that go on, you know, here in North America. And then the second part of this is at the grassroots side of the sport. I say, you know, my belief is that in the near term, at the professional level, the business of cycling has been damaged because we've seen a lot of companies that have been supporters of the sport, and in some cases like Rabobank, which is out of the Netherlands, and they have a presence here in California, they have pulled out of the sport altogether. They were a sponsor of the Tour of California. They pulled out of that. They canceled their sponsorship of their men's pro team, and they've essentially, you know, almost cut all of their ties to cycling. They do sponsor a women's team, and they sponsor a, I believe it's an under-23 team over in Europe. But you're seeing a lot of companies that have been longtime supporters pulling out of the sport. We saw a lot of them just, you know, drop out altogether when the scandal started at the end of last summer. Fortunately, we're seeing, you know, starting to see new companies come back into it, led by business owners that are, you know, executives that are, you know, passionate cyclists. I just think it's going to take a long time.
Mark, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
That was Mark Waite, founder of Cycling CEO. For more information, very simple, jump onto their website, cyclingceo.com. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, Tyler Shaw, Patrick Charles, Ellie from Heather's, as well as Mark Waite. Here is your thought-provoking quote of the week. Each one has to find his peace from within, and peace to be real must be unaffected by outside circumstances. And that comes from Mahatma Gandhi. Thank you so much for hanging out on the show. We always appreciate your time. Make sure to follow us on our social media. Lots of interviews and other awesome things on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Also follow us on Twitter at K Alexander Show, The Kelly Alexander Show on Facebook, and our website, kellyalexandershow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I'll chat soon.